This is Colorado Edition from KUNC. On today's show, we'll look at the impact of the Transcontinental Railroad in our state.
The Transcontinental Railroad essentially unified the country economically, culturally, and politically.
Plus, a look at what's next for legislation that would protect hundreds of thousands of acres of public land in Colorado.
And how communities in the Four Corners are adapting to climate change.
That's coming up.
It's Monday, November 4th. You're listening to KUNC's Colorado Edition, your daily look at news from around the state. I'm Henry Zimmerman.
And I'm Erin O'Toole. Last week, we looked at the bills that two interim state committees approved, one focused on recycling, the other on school safety. This week, we'll turn to two other interim study committees and what legislation they approved to move forward in the next legislative session, which begins in January.
Wildfires have been on people's minds lately, as we've seen fires burning across California and some here in our state. Today, we're turning to the work of Colorado's Wildfire Matters Review Committee. Mark Snyder is a Democratic state representative from El Paso County. Representative Snyder, welcome to Colorado Edition.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your time.
What is the goal of the Wildfire Matters Review Committee?
We have a charging document that basically lays out, our charge to find the best practices and ways to reduce not only the number of wildfires, but certainly the severity of wildfires. As we all know, there's been a lot of change in Colorado over the last 20 years or so, and these fires are more and more prevalent. So our committee is looking for the best practices from whatever source to try and reduce the impact of those fires have on our wonderful neighborhoods and communities.
What do you see as the key weaknesses in Colorado as it relates to our wildfire response?
I think the biggest issue is the WUI, the wildland-urban interface, which has been growing exponentially over these last several decades. As more and more people look for that Colorado quality of life, a lot of these properties are developed in these heavily forested areas. And when a drought and then a wildfire starts, it's really dangerous for our firefighters to get in there and try and protect these homes. So that's been the focus over the last couple of years with this committee.
This committee just approved five pieces of legislation to move forward. Can you tell us a little more about those?
One that I was really interested in myself is expanding our Forest Restoration and Wildfire Risk Mitigation Act. So currently, we do provide grant funding, and we were able to increase that last legislative session by an additional $1 million. But so far, it's been limited to governmental entities, small towns, counties, and it requires a 50% match. And what we're finding out is that a lot of economically disadvantaged communities can't make that 50% match. So we are asking the Forest Service to develop some criteria by which we could declare certain communities under economic hardship, and they could reduce their local matching grant to 25% of the total.
One of the other bills would improve benefits for firefighters, and that doesn't really fit in the realm of, I think, what most of us think in terms of fire prevention. Can you kind of explain that bill and why it was one of the five the committee approved?
Yes, and I agree with you. It does seem a little bit out of the mainstream for the type of work we do on the committee, but this was brought to us directly from the firefighters. So they have to carry us particular types of insurance for cancers and heart disease and other things often that are resulting from fighting wildfires. So this bill just seeks to really make sure that they are covered there, and it also adds them to the classification of state troopers, which allows them to have access to the full para benefits.
I just wanted to ask a little more about some of those other pieces of legislation you looked at. I understand there's an interesting one about homelessness outreach.
That's one that was really near and dear to me. I was mayor of Manitou Springs here during the previous decade or so. I served on council and as mayor. And we have seen that where a lot of times homeless camps, they'll build a fire, and then conditions are bad. Those fires can quickly get out of hand. So we're really going to try and look into how that interfaces with wildfires and how a lot of these homeless folks set up in the woods, off the grid, so to speak. And we're going to be reaching down into those. We're forming a working group that will study best practices and how we can reach that particular community and make sure that they are firewise.
And briefly, could you tell us about the other two?
Well, one is a rather minor matter, but very important, especially to rural counties. That's the one that allows surplus military vehicles that are used in firefighting to use our public roads. Currently, they're prohibited from traveling on our public roads, and you can imagine that could be really detrimental, especially in a more rural area when they're trying to get resources over where they need to be to fight a fire. And the last one, we noticed through all the testimony we had over the summer that really a lot of communities struggle with trying to figure out exactly what resources and grants, et cetera, are available. So we're going to tool some of our grant program to be more educational, do more outreach, and really just be a navigator to help communities find the resources that are available already and see if we can't match them up with their need and get the program going in their community.
What's next for some of these pieces of legislation? Are you feeling confident that when you take these to the session that they'll be received well?
Well, it is a little new for me, so I have a hard time making that prognostication. But our first step will be to go before the Legislative Council. And that's a bipartisan group of both representatives and senators that review all of these interim committee and the bills that they're putting forward. So we'll go up there and we'll hope to get a favorable recommendation from them. And it should all five survive through Legislative Council. Then they'll go through the normal bill process through the legislature. So there's a lot of work left to be done, a lot of public input. More than likely, there'll be amendments and some changes to some of these bills. But we're really confident on the committee that these are five good bills that will get due consideration.
Mark Snyder is the chair of the Wildfire Matters Review Committee. Mark, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Really appreciate it.
Tomorrow, we'll update you on the recommendations from the Opioid and Other Substance Use Disorders Study Committee.
Now let's take a look at today's headlines.
The FBI says it has arrested a man in a plot to bomb a historic Colorado synagogue. The co-conspirators turned out to be undercover agents. Court documents say 27-year-old Richard Holzer was arrested Friday just after the agents brought him what were supposedly two pipe bombs along with dynamite to blow up Temple Emmanuel in Pueblo. The investigation into Holzer began after an undercover FBI agent purporting to be a woman who supports white supremacy contacted him on Facebook. It's not clear if Holzer has a lawyer representing him.
Colorado voters are deciding on two statewide ballot questions tomorrow, along with local council races and tax measures. Proposition CC and DD are the two big questions this year. CC would remove a cap on the amount of tax dollars the state can keep at the end of the year, meaning that the government could spend that money on public education and road improvements. DD would legalize sports betting in Colorado. A new tax on the proceeds would fund a long list of water conservation and infrastructure projects across the state. Kerry Stapleton is with the University of Colorado Boulder. He authored a survey of 800 voters from around the state.
So overall, Proposition DD does seem to have kind of fairly widespread support. Proposition CC, on the other hand, is much more kind of polarized. We see, in general, right now, it looks like Prop CC might go down to defeat.
If you haven't turned in your ballot yet, it's too late to mail them in, but they can be dropped off at local election sites, which you can find online at govotecolorado.com.
Colorado's Women's Hall of Fame will get 10 new inductees next year. Among them are teachers, journalists, doctors, activists, and public servants, like former Colorado Attorney General Gail Norton and labor rights activist Lupe Briceño. The Colorado Women's Hall of Fame inducts a new class of contemporary and historical women every 2 years. More than 160 Colorado women have been honored since the Hall of Fame was founded in 1985.
Climate change has been called the new normal by some, but residents in the Southwest say there's nothing normal about it.
Communities in the Four Corners, where Colorado, Utah, New Mexico, and Arizona meet, have been bouncing between desperately dry and record-breaking moisture for the past few years. KUNC's Luke Runyon has more on how they're adapting.
Dustin Stein is pushing down the wires of an electric fence with his left foot while he swings his other leg over into a pasture. We're trying to get a closer look at his grazing black and brown steers.
The fence is on. Okay. This wire is not.
The 30-something mustachioed rancher lowers the fence just enough for me to straddle it. The dangling cables from my audio recorder barely make it over.
Watch that piece of wire there.
I've never been electrocuted through my recorder, so that would be a first.
Stein has managed Stubborn Farms outside the small town of Mancos in southwestern Colorado for the past 7 years.
So we're a sperm-to-steak grass-fed beef operation.
That's a new one.
You haven't heard that yet?
If you want a sense of what climate change is doing to agriculture in the Southwest, this is a pretty good place to see it on a small scale.
You know, so hot, so dry, so much snow, the river's too high. It's like, it's just incredibly bipolar.
The summer of 2018, for example, was the hottest on record across most of the Four Corners. With irrigation water tapped out and his pastures brown, Stein was forced to send all his cattle to high mountain pastures 200 miles to the north near Gunnison.
Because there was no way that we were going to be able to economically keep them fed here in the valley.
Then, this past winter, snowpack in some parts of the nearby San Juan Mountains was at its highest level ever, leaving parched communities having to quickly prepare for flooding. And before anyone could catch their breath, drought returned this summer.
I feel like I haven't had a break in, I don't know, 18 months or something.
Some scientists and practitioners have referred to this as climate whiplash.
Greg Garfin is a climatologist at the University of Arizona. For ranchers like Dustin Stein, he says climate change is not some far-off problem. It's affecting people now.
In the Southwest, we live in a very variable climate to begin with. And I think one of the concerns is about enhanced variation.
Meaning rising temperatures lead to less snow and lower rivers, which in turn limits which livelihoods can survive. There's lots of talk about adapting to a changing climate. But for small-scale farmers and ranchers, rearranging their operations is expensive.
You know, it's a cost. It's something you have to plan really for.
Carrie Padgett is a water engineer based in Durango. She points to irrigation. Much of that infrastructure was built almost a century ago. Both drought and flood have put big strains on their systems.
I think most people are living day to day in their operations, and they're not able to have that forethought to really save the money to plan for those future costs or replacements.
Okay, so that's kind of sub-irrigated, which is nice.
Back in Mancos, rancher Dustin Stein is thinking about how to make changes to his ranch to better mirror the erratic weather. Unlike some of the old-timers who ranch nearby, Stein will likely be around to see climate change reshape the Southwest.
We're literally on the edge of 14,000-foot mountains in between dry desert. And so I can see how that dry desert will slowly creep in towards us.
I think some people would look at you and be like, get out of there.
And some days I have those thoughts, but my heart is really here.
Plus, he says, there's something inspiring and exciting about being an early adapter, at least for now. Taking an historic livelihood like ranching and figuring out how to keep it going, even when it looks like all the cards are stacked against it. I'm Luke Runyon in Mancos, Colorado.
You're listening to Colorado Edition from KUNC.
Last week, the Colorado Outdoor Recreation Economy, or CORE Act, passed a vote in the U.S. House of Representatives. The bill, which would protect around 400,000 acres of public land in Colorado, seems unlikely to pass through the Senate, and the Trump administration has said they would veto the act if it does. Joining us now to help us understand the politics surrounding this bill is Jesse Paul, a politics reporter for the Colorado Sun. Hi, Jesse.
Hi, how you doing?
The CORE Act would protect hundreds of thousands of acres of land in our state. Walk us through what land specifically would be protected.
The bulk of the land is actually in southwest Colorado, kind of in the Telluride, Silverton area. But there's also a large chunk between Carbondale and Peonia, at a section called the Thompson Divide, and then another sliver over in Summit County, kind of between Breckenridge and Leadville, really centered around an area called Camp Hale, which is where the 10th Mountain Division, Colorado's iconic military force that helped form all of our, most of our ski areas in the state, was based during the Second World War.
Colorado delegation voted along party lines. Democrats voted for the bill, Republicans against it. Why was it so divisive?
This has kind of been the new narrative with this bill. It's always been pitched as this really collaborative piece of legislation that's been around for about a decade and has been the result of a lot of on-the-ground discussions with local communities throughout Colorado's western slope. But I'd say in the past 2 weeks, we've started to see really thick partisan lines be drawn in the sand around this legislation, where you have Democratic delegation pushing extremely hard for this and the Republicans pumping the brakes, specifically U.S. Representative Scott Tipton, a Cortez Republican, whose district includes the majority of the lands that this bill would affect.
He's actually proposed another bill called the Colorado Recreation Enhancement and Conservation Act, or Colorado REC Act. It's similar to CORE, but there are some differences. Can you explain what those are?
So one of the biggest differences with this piece of legislation is that it does not include a provision that would bar new oil and gas leases along the Thompson Divide, that area between Carbondale and Peonia I was talking about earlier. This has really been a sticking point for this idea, this measure, since it's been discussed. However, Scott Tipton has now dropped his opposition to that point in the CORE Act, so it's not clear what the Colorado REC Act's future is. That bill was never actually introduced. It was kind of just a discussion draft that he had some discussions and conversations, roundtables with in communities on the Western Slope. But what that bill really was is kind of an alternative to the CORE Act, where Tipton said, look, you know, I don't agree with what Democrats have put forward. Here's my solution to getting this passed. I'm willing to work with the other side to try and find some kind of compromise. But if we can't reach it, I have this to fall back on.
We had mentioned earlier that it seems unlikely it'll pass through the Senate. But should it pass through the Senate, the Trump administration has said they would veto it. Why is that? And is it typical to have a president weigh in on legislation like this?
And just to go back to the Senate piece, I think it's important to mention that Cory Gardner, Colorado's Republican junior senator, is not supportive of the act. He's not blocking it. He's not trying to hold it up in any way. But he's got some significant issues with the bill that he sees as kind of non-starters in terms of his support. And in a Republican-controlled Senate, I think it would be very difficult to foresee a piece of legislation getting through without the support of the Republican senator from that state. So, you know, unless they can kind of find some compromise, I think at this point, the odds of it passing the Senate are quite slim. Then you have this other big elephant in the room, which is the fact that even if it were to pass the Senate on these unlikely odds and make it to the White House, President Donald Trump right now, his advisors are saying that they would tell him to veto it. And they left open the possibility that if significant changes to the bill were made, that they could sign on. But they didn't give specifics, though their complaints generally sounded pretty close to what Tipton and Gardner have told us about what their concerns are with the legislation.
Both Representative Tipton and Senator Cory Gardner are up for election a year from now. How does their lack of support for CORE play into their upcoming campaigns and into the campaigns of their challengers?
So we saw very early on in this cycle that Democrats and environmental groups were going to try and paint Republicans in Colorado as being anti-environment, anti-public lands. So the bill, the CORE Act, you're already starting to see some Democrats attack Tipton and Gardner over their lack of support for the bill. In Tipton's case, James Iacino, a new candidate in the district, sent out a news release blasting Tipton for not voting for the bill on Thursday. And then former Colorado Governor John Hickenlooper has started a digital campaign to try and pressure Gardner to support the bill. This obviously is already a complicated piece of legislation to begin with. Adding in electoral politics into it and what we're heading into an election year is kind of like an extra wrench into already slow moving gears. So this has gotten just exponentially more complicated with politics and elections being thrown into the mix.
Jesse Paul is a politics reporter for the Colorado Sun. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much.
150 years ago, the first transcontinental railroad in the United States was completed. The Union Pacific and Central Pacific Railroad companies, who were building westward from Omaha, Nebraska, and eastward from Sacramento, California, respectively, finally met at Promontory Point in Utah. And the impacts of its construction were felt around the country, even in states like Colorado that weren't part of the original route. Colorado was later connected by the Denver Pacific Railroad. Here to tell us more about the legacy of the Transcontinental Railroad in Colorado and the West is William Way. He is a history professor at the University of Colorado Boulder and the state historian. Professor Way, welcome to Colorado Edition.
Thank you.
How would you describe the legacy of the Transcontinental Railroad?
I think the Transcontinental Railroad was immensely important to the development of the United States in general and the interior West in particular. The Transcontinental Railroad essentially unified the country economically, culturally, and politically. It made it possible for us to develop the interior West and make it a place that was viable. And the people who did this were immigrant workers. The Central Pacific was built mainly by Chinese immigrants. They constituted 90% of the workers. And the Union Pacific was constructed mainly by Irish immigrant workers. Whenever I think about that, I believe that they were the ones who won the West rather than the romanticized cowboy, which is part of our national narrative.
What did having this cross-country railroad mean for the West at this point?
Without the railroad, and of course without the people who built the railroad, the West would have remained in a state of, shall we say, underdevelopment. As you know, Colorado built its economy on the extraction of mineral resources, gold, silver, coal. Those resources would have remained in the ground, because once you take it from the ground, you have to transport it somewhere. And without the railroad, it would have not gone anywheres. The railroad was indispensable to the state's development. That's one of the reasons why Dr. John Evans and others in Colorado decided to build the Denver Pacific to connect it to the Union Pacific up there in Cheyenne, Wyoming, to ensure that we would have access to those external markets. Without it, Denver, as one of the leaders of the Union Pacific noted, would be dead as a doornail. It would be, in effect, a ghost town like many others in the state without this connection.
I know you've written a book titled Asians in Colorado. How did the creation of this railroad contribute to or kind of shape Asian immigration to our state?
After they built the railroad, many of the Chinese continued to be employed in the building of other railroads, including the repair of the Union Pacific. After working on the railroad, they sought other occupations, and that included mining and other activities in Colorado. If you look at Chinese American history, you'll note that Chinese could be found in all kinds of occupations until, quite frankly, they were driven out of them and limited to only a handful. They persevered, they found work, they found whatever work was allowed them, and they contributed then to the development of Colorado's infrastructure, making Colorado a viable place to live. For their contributions and their sacrifices, they were subject to persecution and ethnic cleansing in the West in general, as well as, of course, Colorado.
I'm wondering if you can draw any parallels from this point in history to today.
We live in a period of time in which we have seen the resurrection, if you will, of animus towards immigrants, especially those south of the border. And many of the accusations that have been leveled against the Chinese, as well as other unfavored groups of immigrants, are now being leveled against our more recent immigrants. Just like in the past, those allegations are unfounded, and they've been made essentially to erect a wall against them, when, in fact, immigrants have been shown to be major contributors to America, to its economy, to its society, to its culture. We have benefited immensely from it. It's one of the things that has, quite frankly, distinguished us from other nations. We have many ideals, and it's our commitment to those ideals, which includes, well, equality among people, that has attracted people to this country. I would argue that this nativism is fundamentally un-American.
William Way is a history professor at the University of Colorado Boulder and the Colorado State Historian. Professor, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
And that's our show for today. Tomorrow, we'll learn about the startups that are helping families deal with childcare deserts in our state. I'm Henry Zimmerman.
And I'm Erin O'Toole. Our show is produced by Lily Tyson. Brian Larson is our executive producer.
Thanks for listening. This is Colorado Edition from KUNC.